Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on AirsLA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 351 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut, to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, space, light, and shade, which changes in every garden. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And, as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. As we digest all the hoopla across the country from the celebrations of America's 250th birthday, weren't those tall ships wonderful? And the great disappointment of the men's soccer team and the World Cup being beaten by the Belgians, we turn now to an article by Ferris Yaber, published on the 7th of July in the New York Times Magazine and updated one day later. I wanted an ecologically responsible garden. It was harder than I thought. The native plant movement gets a lot right, but there's so much more to consider. This is a longer article than normal, so bear with us. In the summer of 2020, my husband Ryan and I bought a house in Portland, Oregon, with a sizable backyard containing little more than a decrepit lawn. For many prospective homeowners, a crisped rectangle of green on the verge of death would probably not be a selling point. We found it irresistible, an ideal canvas for our dream garden. That fall, we hired a contractor to rip out what remained of the lawn and got to work. From the start, we tried to balance several conflicting priorities. We wanted our garden to be beautiful and bountiful, teeming with fruits, vegetables, and flowers. But we had also resolved to conserve water, minimize the use of fertilizer, and exclude synthetic pesticides. We intended to maintain a functional oasis where we could relax and entertain friends, yet we were also determined to provide plenty of habitat and resources for wildlife. This was an opportunity to steward a parcel of our living planet, however small. Throughout the garden, we planted hardy, drought-tolerant perennials, lavender, coreopsis, penstemon, sea holly, sunroses, and sedum. Here and there, we mixed in some favorite flowers that required a bit more pampering, like peonies, dahlias, and Peruvian lilies. We dug a small pond and bog, laid a flagstone path, espaliered a couple of fruit trees along the fence, and built raised vegetable beds in the back. We set up a compost bin, installed drip irrigation, and began to mulch. 2 years later, the once sterile landscape was reborn, vibrant and lush, and bustling with life. Insects were the first to arrive. I was especially captivated by the diversity of wild bees, most of which I never knew existed. Tiny metallic blue mason bees teleported between apple and cherry blossoms. Glittering green sweat bees swooped upon the poppies. Fluffy-bellied leafcutter bees slice through the air with vegetal clippings clasped between their legs. The pageant of small winged visitors soon expanded to dragonflies, hoverflies, butterflies, and beetles. Then came substantially larger animals, songbirds, hummingbirds, birds of prey, jumping mice, and a mischievous family of raccoons that, based on the aftermath, routinely held some sort of bacchanal in the pond. I was confident that the garden we were cultivating was not only attractive and productive, but ecologically beneficial, too. But the more I engaged with the wider community of wildlife gardeners, the more my confidence wilted. Wherever I turned, local nurseries, online forums, best-selling books, like-minded gardeners seemed to care about one thing above all else, whether their plants were native. A vast majority of plants sold in North American nurseries are foreign species, imported sometime in the past few centuries. In contrast, native species are those with long evolutionary histories in the particular regions they inhabit. Native plant champions argue that, unlike recently introduced species, native species are thoroughly adapted to their surroundings and have long-standing, mutually beneficial relationships with one another. Therefore, they claim native plants are far better at providing food and shelter for wildlife and maintaining the integrity of their ecosystems. Growing natives is not new. Indigenous peoples have cultivated native species for millenniums, and some nursery owners have encouraged American gardeners to focus on native plants since at least the early 20th century. In the past decade, however, what was once regarded as a niche concern of the environmentally conscious has begun growing into a nationwide movement. Surveys from the National Gardening Association and the National Wildlife Federation indicate that since 2019, the share of U.S. gardening households buying native plants has ranged from about 1 in 5 to nearly 1 in 3. 82% of horticultural professionals agree that consumer interest in natives is increasing, and more than half of those will sell natives plant to expand their selection. Taking all this in, I began to question our garden's true ecological value. Sure, we had planted a few Pacific Northwest natives, but most of the plants we selected originated elsewhere. I'd been thinking of our garden as a miniature Eden, replete with everything local wildlife needed. Now it seemed more like a poorly stocked international aisle at a supermarket, offering a few exotic curiosities, yet lacking the familiar essentials. As I continued researching the supposed virtues of native plants, one name in particular kept resurfacing, Douglas Tallamy. A professor of entomology at the University of Delaware, a conservationist, and a frequent public speaker, Tallamy is the nation's foremost expert advocate for gardening with native plants. Collectively, his 6 books have sold more than 500,000 copies, soaring in popularity in recent years. Many of the native plant movement's followers regard Tallamy with the kind of deep reverence typically reserved for spiritual leaders. Based on 3 decades of research, he is convinced that the co-evolved relationships between native plants and insects sustain all terrestrial food webs, and that typical American gardens, landscaped with lawns and showy exotics, are essentially ecological wastelands. He argues that foreign and invasive plant species, most of which have been introduced through the ornamental plant trade, are some of the primary causes of the so-called insect apocalypse and the current staggering rates of biodiversity loss more broadly. For Tallamy, these insights simultaneously underscore a calamity and point to its potential resolution. The type of plants we choose to bring into and keep out of our gardens will, quote, determine what nature will be like in 10, 20, and 50 years from now, unquote, he writes in Bringing Nature Home. Increasing the percentage of natives in suburbia is a grassroots solution to the extinction crisis. Success, he emphasizes, can spring from the individual rather than from government. As gardeners and stewards of our land, we have never been so empowered, and the ecological stakes have never been so high. Tallamy has expanded this argument into an initiative he calls Homegrown National Park. Across the nation, at least 40 million acres are covered with mostly foreign turf grasses that demand huge volumes of water, fertilizer, and fuel yet have little ecological value. Much of this grass resides on private property. Tallamy wants to inspire a mass movement to replace half of this acreage with productive native plant communities. If such an effort were successful, it would create a mosaic of new wildlife habitats larger than all the national parks in the contiguous United States combined, a prospect that gives Tallamy shivers. Although Tallamy's expertise and passion were compelling, I harbored some skepticism about the native plant doctrine. Given how drastically different the world is today compared with even a century ago, I wondered whether the bygone circumstances in which species evolved could really be so important. If introduced plants were so ecologically inferior, it was difficult to explain why our yard in Portland was pulsing with bees and birds. Like many other gardeners, I also bristled at the narrow-minded attitudes of the most extreme nativists. Before I started ripping up my flower beds, I needed to address a few pressing questions. How did Tallamy arrive at his conclusions? Beyond his own work, how much science supported the native plant movement? And if its central premise was correct, then what should a modern-day ecologically responsible garden look like exactly? There seemed to be no better place to start seeking answers than in Tallamy's own yard. Native trees, shrubs, and flowers abound in his gloriously wooded 10-acre property in southeastern Pennsylvania, the culmination of a nearly 30-year restoration effort. Even the long unpaved driveway leading to his house is shaded by an archway of overlapping boughs. When I reached its end one warm spring morning, I found myself directly beneath a magnificent 70-foot-tall white oak that Tallamy planted as an acorn. Around his house, pollinators flitted among buttery wood poppies, fringe-petaled phacelia, and nodding red columbines. The trills of wrens and vireos resounded overhead, accompanied by the occasional drumming of woodpeckers. Over the next several days, we traipsed through Tallamy's property, a patchwork of forest, meadow, and marsh, conversing about plants and looking for wildlife. It was not difficult to find. At one point, we came upon a cluster of American carrion beetles lapping up the sap of an oak tree, a behavior Tallamy had never before observed. Soon after, while inspecting the leaves of a pawpaw, we discovered a peculiar insect known as a clavate tortoise beetle, which resembled a miniature bearskin rug encased in a disc of gelatin. I then literally stumbled onto one of our more exciting finds of the week, a thrumming cloud of small native bees hovering just above their burrows waiting for the chance to mate. One night, we set up a couple of bug-beguiling lights near Tallamy's house. Hundreds of moths gradually emerged from the darkness, some arriving as lightly as a snowflake, others convulsing through the leaf litter. As the night unfolded, larger and more striking individuals joined the initially small and homely congregation. A Harris's three-spot with hypnotic monochromatic swirls, a sunset orange Isabella tiger moth, and a small-eyed sphinx with scallop wings that seemed to be cut from marbled endpaper. Just before midnight, when I was thinking of retiring, the species we had most hoped to see came crashing through the canopy, a Luna moth, massive yet ethereal, with long, swooping tails and the wings the color of absinthe. All told, Tallamy has now documented more than 1,370 moth species, and 62 species of breeding birds on his land, which constitute 44% of all moth species and 33% of all bird species in the state. When Tallamy and his wife, Cindy, a retired entomologist, bought their property in 2000, it was nothing like this. Historically, much of the land was farmed and mowed for hay. In the areas where wild plants still grew, there were hardly any trees and few natives. Instead, they found an impenetrable tangle of invasive shrubs and vines, multiflora rose, oriental bittersweet, Japanese honeysuckle, and autumn olive, all of which tend to spread aggressively, out competing natives. Tallamy had to cut paths through the overgrowth just to navigate the landscape. When he started searching the vegetation for insect life, something he does everywhere, out of habit, he was shocked by how little he found. He had a hunch about the conspicuous absence. Perhaps there were no insects because, despite the leafy abundance, there was little they could eat. We tend to think of milkweed-dependent monarch butterflies and other insects with restrictive diets as exceptions to the general voracity of their kind. The hordes of vampiric aphids, swarms of locusts, and ceaseless trails of foraging ants. The reality, Talamy explains, is that most leaf-eating insects are exceptionally picky eaters. Plants deter herbivores with an extensive apothecary of toxins, repellents, and digestive inhibitors. In response, and since insects must develop countermeasures, like the ability to neutralize or sequester a particular class of compounds. The ensuing coevolution results in widespread dietary specialization. Around three-quarters of leaf-eating insect species in any given location on the globe are eating only plants within a single taxonomic family. In many cases, they are restricted to one or a few lineages within that broader group. Insects, in turn, are perhaps the single most vital conduit of energy from plants to animals. Birds illustrate this point especially well. By Talamy's reckoning, nearly all terrestrial bird species in North America rely primarily on insects, in particular plump and nutritious caterpillars, to feed their young and maintain breeding populations. An average brood of 6 to 8 chickadees demands 3 to 5,000 feedings over the 16 days from hatching to fledging, most of which will be caterpillars, other insects, and spiders. The displacement of native plants on his property, Talamy reasoned, had severed the most foundational threads of the local food web, depriving insects of sustenance and thus endangering all other animals that depended on them. Surely the same thing had been happening across the continent for centuries. When he surveyed the scientific literature for relevant studies focused on how invasive plants alter food webs, however, he didn't find any that met his criteria. So he decided to fill the gap. In the past 3 decades, Talamy and his colleagues have published numerous studies demonstrating that native plants typically support more biodiversity than introduced species, and that gardening can play an important role in restoring wildlife habitat. Their research has shown, for example, that hedgerows dominated by invasive plants have 91% fewer caterpillars than indigenous varieties, and that yards landscaped primarily with native plants have 66% more bird species than conventional yards. One especially celebrated study determined that Carolina chickadees breeding in urban and suburban yards raised enough young to sustain their populations only when the mass of trees and shrubs within and around those yards were at least 70% native. By scouring records of insect diets, Talamy and his collaborators have further revealed that across the United States, small groups of keystone plants, on average just 14% of the natives in a given region, feed more than 90% of local butterflies and moths. Trees and shrubs consistently rank highest in terms of how many insects they support, in part because they are larger and longer lived. These studies became the basis for the National Wildlife Federation's popular online tool for gardeners, the Native Plant Finder. In tandem, Talamy and Cindy applied the findings to their own garden. They used tractors, chains, shears, and saws to fell, uproot, and destroy as many invasives as they could. In some cases, Talamy also applied herbicides. Eliminating all introduced species proved impossible. Multiflora rose still forms a few thickets. Porcelain berry and mile-a-minute weed produce copious seed and regenerate from resilient roots. Japanese stilt grass is absolutely everywhere, carpeting the ground like a forest of dwarf bamboo. On the whole, however, Talamy regards the restoration as a triumph. Instead of jumbled invasives, there are now towering stands of native trees, oaks, maples, beeches, cherries, plums, and myriad native shrubs and understory plants, such as sassafras, winterberry, and azaleas. Talamy estimates that he and Cindy planted only 10% of those trees and shrubs. Most arrived as seeds via rodents, birds, and wind. By tipping the scale toward natives, they gave the ecosystem the time and opportunity it needed to regenerate itself. The earth is falling apart, and everyone feels, well, what can one person do? Tallamy says. I've got a whole list of things one person can do. His central message to his readers, he says, is they are not just homeowners. They are the hope and future of conservation. Tallamy's penchant for grandiose claims is one reason he has faced criticism from some scientists and gardeners. His unabashed and polarized attitudes toward native and introduced species have proved even more controversial. In our discussions, Tallamy described invasive species to me with palpable contempt, sometimes referring to them as ecological tumors. His critics contend that he and other nativists place too much emphasis on origin, idolizing indigenous species, vilifying migrants, and eliding the messiness of real-world ecosystems in the Anthropocene. Most of the species that humans move from one area to another never become problematic. Only a portion of foreign species survive relocation, and only a fraction of the survivors become invasive. Experts agree, however, that certain introduced species have been undeniable ecological disasters. One of the most famous examples is the brown tree snake, which reached the shores of Guam shortly after World War II, most likely aboard a cargo ship. Liberated from their usual predators and surrounded with abundant and naive prey, brown tree snakes thrived, consuming so much of the native fauna that more than half of the island's bird and bat species became locally extinct. Similarly, when horticulturists accidentally brought a parasitic Asian fungus to North America in the late 19th century, it devastated the continent's once vast and majestic stands of native chestnut trees. In other cases, however, introduced species have few noticeable effects or provide ecological benefits. At first, Pacific oysters introduced to Europe's North Sea smothered native mussels. Over time, however, the two species became more compatible, forming mixed, multi-layered reefs in which oysters dominate but simultaneously shelter mussels from predators. These hybrid reefs also seem to be more resilient to extreme weather. In Puerto Rico, introduced tree species have quickly repopulated deforested land in which natives initially struggled to grow. Over several decades, the forest evolved into novel communities in which both natives and non-natives flourished. One of Tallamy's most prominent critics is the esteemed entomologist Arthur Shapiro, emeritus professor at the University of California, Davis. Shapiro has shown that more than 30% of California's butterfly species use introduced plants as hosts for their larvae, typically because these species are either related to their native foods or happen to have similar leaf chemistry. Some North American butterflies have even expanded their geographic ranges and reproduced seasons by adapting to foreign plants. Groups of Anis swallowtail, for example, breed so well on fennel, which was most likely introduced by Europeans in the early 19th century, that they began producing additional generations each year. Monarch butterflies migrating along the West Coast frequently rest and shelter in groves of tall, winter-blooming eucalyptus trees, which a merchant sea captain imported from Australia to the United States in the 1850s. Introduced plants have enabled butterflies and moths to extend their ranges in New England, the Northwest, and Europe as well. On a more fundamental level, a vocal cohort of ecologists, historians, and philosophers argues that the concept of native and invasive species, which they equate with xenophobia and militarism, should be reworked or abandoned. Ecosystems, they say, are not delicate, finely knit tapestries that permanently unravel if they lose too many threads. They are more like modular conglomerates in a state of constant flux. Environments are always changing. Species move around on their own. And at this point, humans have so radically altered the planet's climate, landscapes, and biogeography that recreating the habitats in which most species originally evolved is impossible. In their view, native purists are obsessed with preserving a static and idealized version of nature that never really existed. From a deep time planetary perspective, there is no distinction between native and non-native. All life is equally earthly. All extant species are branches of a single ancient trunk. Every newborn island, freshly thawed sheet of bedrock, or other novel biome must be populated with creatures whose histories lie elsewhere. On more relatable timetables, however, ecological belonging is a meaningful concept. Coevolution is not some rarefied process that occasionally spits out a few unusually codependent species. All species co-evolve in networks in specific places, under certain conditions, over particular periods of time. The relationships they form with one another and their environments define their ecosystems. Such communities are resilient to an extent, but if the most fundamental connections within them collapse too quickly, so will the systems as we know them. Promoting some plants over others does not mean we judge them to be inherently superior or the others to be wicked. Rather, it recognizes that different life forms are connected to each other in different ways. Certain species tend to reinforce and renew the ecosystems in which they take part, whereas others, through no fault of their own, and often because of our own blunders, may imbalance or exhaust them. The most formidable challenges to Talamy's grand vision are not the nuances of nativeness, but the realities of scale. The idea of a homegrown national park is galvanizing. I interviewed several scientists who agreed that it would have legitimate ecological benefits. But no gardening movement, however big, can create enough wildlife habitat to avert the extinction crisis. More than half the land in the contiguous United States is devoted not to gardens, parks, or golf courses, but to farms and ranches. Another 30% is managed forest, much of which is logged. Less than 6% is occupied by cities, major suburbs, and their constituent green spaces. The 20 million acres of grass lawn that Talamy proposes converting to native plant communities amount to a mere 1%. Talamy acknowledges this constraint, yet in books, talks, and interviews, he continues to declare the power of the average gardener to determine the future of conservation, of North America's biodiversity, and of nature itself. In reality, reversing the current rates of biodiversity loss, which are inextricably linked to climate change, will require substantial reforms to industrial agriculture, forestry, and energy systems, not to mention transcending the vested interests and corrupt politics that have long prevented such change. Gardening with an ecological mindset can be empowering, rekindling a sense of agency that is all too easily extinguished by the overwhelming pressure of a planetary crisis. But when green thumb idealism grows to ungainly proportions, blocking out the wider world, when it begins to seed the public with the impression that their backyard oases alone can decide the fate of life on Earth, it risks becoming a dangerously smug and naive conceit. Within the gardening community, the significance of a plant's origins remains contentious. On one end of the spectrum, sanctimonious nativists admonish anyone who dares to grow a single plant not indigenous to their zip code. On the other, die-hard ornamentalists refuse to relinquish their beloved exotics, denouncing the push for more natives as puritanical. In my interviews with professional gardeners, landscape designers, and other plants people who have been inspired by Talamy, however, they rarely insisted that Americans uproot every non-native plant on their properties. Rather, they tended to favor a hybrid approach of strategically incorporating introduced species into majority native plantings. The evidence that Talamy and his peers have amassed persuasively demonstrates that prioritizing native plants is one of the most effective ways for gardeners to provide habitat and resource for wildlife. Review papers synthesizing nearly 200 studies have echoed their findings, as has new research emerging from multiple independent labs in the United States and abroad. Perhaps the most single beneficial change a gardener can make, Talamy says, is planting a native tree or shrub. At the same time, there are valid ecological reasons to include introduced species in a garden too, a point that even Talamy concedes. The interactions between native plants and herbivorous insects on which he fixates, while undeniably important, are still just one aspect of any green space, cultivated or wild. There is so much more to consider. The climate is now changing so rapidly that many species are struggling to adapt. Researchers have found that introduced species sometimes outperform natives in coping with the extreme and volatile weather that will increasingly characterize future climates. A consortium of experts, based in part at the University of California, Davis, has highlighted certain trees, shrubs, and flowers from Asia, Australia, and South America, in addition to numerous North American species, as suitable choices for streetscapes and gardens in California's Sacramento Valley. Because they are pest-resistant, non-invasive, tolerant of drought, heat, and cold, and, in some cases, beneficial to local wildlife. This part of California used to be a grassland with historically few tree species, says Emily Meineke, an entomologist at UC Davis. She is not directly involved with the consortium. Given how much we need shade, can we really argue that we should only plant native? If we still want to have functional plant communities, I think we have to look at every avenue. I can't imagine Davis transitioning to future climates without some component of introduced species. Non-natives can also significantly expand the resources available to pollinators. Insects, birds, and other creatures that sustain themselves with pollen and nectar typically have more flexible diets than leaf-eating species because, unlike leaves, flowers evolve to attract animals. Yet many ecoregions have seasonal gaps during which few, if any, native plants are blooming. Introduced species can fill these voids, which is especially helpful as climate change threatens to push native pollinators and flowers further out of sync. Recent studies have also revealed that some garden cultivars are as attractive to native insects as their wild progenitors, and, in a few cases, preferred, possibly because their flowers are more colorful, longer-lasting, or more alluringly shaped. Other introduced species provide gardeners themselves with sustenance, medicine, beauty, and joy. A majority of fruits, vegetables, and herbs that U.S. gardeners enjoy growing at home evolved elsewhere and are now so dependent on intensive human care that they have essentially no chance of becoming invasive. Some natives spread or seed too vigorously to be practical in a typical urban garden, or are too drab to suit most gardeners' tastes, whereas many ornamentals are self-contained yet spectacular, enthralling us with radiant hues, intoxicating scents, and exquisite patterns that natives cannot always match. And then there are the all-environmental considerations that are not strictly related to the origin of garden plants. Conserving water, protecting and nurturing soil, preventing pesticide drift and fertilizer runoff, and providing topographically distinct microhabitats, tall grass, dense shrubs, sand, mud, to name a few. To fully support wildlife, a garden needs more than vegetation. Rocks, logs, and stumps instantly provide shade and shelter for small animals, breeding grounds for insects, and unique foraging opportunities for birds. Likewise, a persistent body of water is one of the most important and appealing resources a gardener can offer all sorts of creatures. If an in-ground pond or bog is not feasible, a container pond is an easy alternative. A freestanding pot, tub, or barrel filled with water and a few aquatic plants. I've come to regard an emphasis on gardening with natives as a useful but by no means infallible heuristic, a proxy for a plant's potential to integrate with a particular ecosystem. Plants are not interchangeable commodities. They are animate individuals with distinct roles in their communities. The most specific and relevant questions any ecologically minded gardener can ask about their plants has more to do with conduct than origin. Not so much where are you from, as what will you do? What will these plants do for the soil, for wildlife, for people, and for the ecosystem at large? Perhaps the most ecologically responsible way to garden is neither by exalting natives to the exclusion of all other species, nor by dismissing them as romanticized relics, but by practicing intentional multiplicity, by planting in plural. Gardening attunes us to fundamental truths that much of Western culture continues to resist, that we are neither above nor apart from the multitudes of other living things all around us, that our fates are intertwined, that we will only thrive together, each of us with the opportunity to care for a part of our living, breathing, leafy planet. Whether a rural estate, suburban yard, or container garden on a city stoop, can choose to deny or embrace these truths. A garden can perpetuate a legacy of hubris and self-serving extraction, of continually depleting the earth. A garden can also celebrate, nourish, and renew the relationships that sustain our world. Although I can't quite bring myself to tear up 6 years of growth in my own yard and start over, I've begun a long-term campaign to substantially increase the proportion of native species, selectively replacing certain ornamentals, keeping others, and making use of every available niche. So far, I've added 7 compact native trees and shrubs, including an Oregon crabapple, cascara, and serviceberry, and dozens of native flowers. This fall, I'm going to take advantage of a shed reconstruction project to replant an adjacent bed, substituting a drought-tolerant native willow underplanted with a mix of native grasses and shrubs for some densely ruffled dahlias that are useless to pollinators and overrepresented sedums. I've also started replacing patches of creeping Jenny and speedwell, rapidly spreading Eurasian ground covers I already had reservations about planting with native strawberries, which, according to Talamy's research, feed more butterflies and moths than any other small flowering plant in this region. I thought it would take at least a couple of years for the native plants to settle in and entice new residents, but I'm already noticing a difference. I cannot recall previously seeing a single caterpillar in the garden, yet in the past month I discovered the caterpillars of a native butterfly and sphinx moth feeding on yarrow and primrose. Other moths appear to be pupating in the leaves of several native trees and shrubs, stitching them into makeshift bed chambers. 5 native bee species recently visited the garden for the first time, bringing the total tally to 32, and something is definitely nibbling the cascara. This May, a birdhouse Ryan and I set up several years ago finally welcomed its first occupants, a pair of black-capped chickadees. For more than 2 weeks, we watched them fly tirelessly to and fro every few minutes, foraging meals from nearby trees. Nearly every time they returned, they had a caterpillar, moth, or spider in their beaks, eliciting a frenzied chorus of tin whistle cheeps from the seemingly insatiable nestlings. Given the many sophisticated and subtle ways in which plants and animals communicate, including chemical messages that waft off leaves and permeate the air, I can't help wondering if the insects and birds detected the sudden influx of native vegetation. I'd like to think that, on some level at least, the local wildlife recognizes our efforts to be better neighbors and stewards, that they experience our garden not as theft or intrusion, but as a refuge, a reparation, and a mutual reinvigoration of the world we make together. This episode featured an article by Ferris Jobber, magazine contributing writer for the New York Times, that was published on July 7th, updated the next day. I wanted an ecologically responsible garden. It was harder than I thought. That wraps up this edition 351 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send your comments at www.larrs.org or email us at oneword laradioreading@gmail.com. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us even as we try to create order and impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined dedicated garden area, planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.